imagine sitting at your desk, you know, maybe you're in Bogota and you're staring at a screen.
Right.
You're halfway through a practice test.
Yeah.
You read a sentence,
yep.
look at the blank space, and spot an answer choice that just perfectly translates into the word you're thinking of in Spanish.
Oh, yeah.
You click it, you feel a huge surge of confidence, and you move on. But what you probably don't realize is that the test makers designed that exact answer choice to look flawless to someone translating English in their head.
It's a beautifully constructed trap, honestly.
Exactly. I mean, many students prepare for the SAT by just studying more and more content, like drilling flashcards, memorizing formulas, and, you know, hoping for the best.
Yeah, but improvement also depends on understanding what each question actually measures, right?
Right. And how the digital format works and what your mistakes reveal about your decision-making process. So today, we are handing you a complete strategic map of the digital asset. We're going to break down how to understand this test from the inside out and build a highly effective preparation system, especially if you're an international student taking this for the very first time.
Definitely.
But before we get into the mechanics of it all, I feel like I have to clear something up because I see a lot of international students who have already taken the TOEFL or the IELTS, and they walk into the ESSA assuming it's just, you know, another English proficiency test.
Yeah.
That's a pretty dangerous assumption to make, isn't it?
Oh, it is. It's a very common misunderstanding, but it's fundamentally flawed.
Yeah.
To put it simply, the SIA is a standardized college admissions assessment, and it's used primarily by institutions in the United States. Though, you know, it's worth mentioning that admissions requirements vary widely by institution.
Right. It's not a universal rule.
Exactly. And a test score alone does not guarantee admission anywhere. But regarding your point on English proficiency, the SAT assumes a baseline of English comprehension.
That makes sense.
What the SAT actually measures goes far beyond fluency. It's assessing academic skills, evidence-based decision-making, and problem-solving under really strict time constraints.
Wow.
Yeah. It evaluates your reading comprehension, your writing and language logic, and mathematical reasoning. And I want to be incredibly clear right at the start.
Yeah.
It is not an IQ test.
Thank you. That is so important to say.
It really is. Your score is a measurement of specific academic skills developed over time. It is absolutely not a measurement of your inherent intelligence or personal worth.
I think framing it as a measure of specific buildable skills changes the whole, like, emotional tone of preparing for it.
I agree completely.
But obviously, before a student can begin to practice those skills, they have to know exactly what they're walking into.
Right.
We can't build a strategy without understanding the physical terrain of test day. So let's look at the blueprint. The numbers are incredibly specific.
They are.
The test always starts with the reading and writing section.
Correct.
That gives you 54 questions in total, and you have exactly 64 minutes to complete it. And it's divided into two separate modules.
Right, so that's 27 questions per module.
Yeah, and you get 32 minutes per module. Now, if you do the math on that, it averages out to approximately 1 minute and 11 seconds per question.
Yeah.
Looking at those numbers, a minute and change per question sounds terrifying. Does it feel that fast in the room?
Well, it can definitely feel accelerated if you aren't prepared for the rhythm of it.
Right.
That's why time management is treated as a core skill on the SAT, not just an administrative detail. After you finish those two reading and writing modules, you get a break. One 10-minute break.
And you should probably take that break, right?
Yeah. I always advise students to actually take it. Step away from the screen, look at something far away to rest your eyes, you know, just reset your focus.
Because right after that, you sit back down for math.
Exactly.
And the math section has 44 questions total, and you have 70 minutes.
Right.
Again, divided into two modules. That means 22 questions and 35 minutes per module.
Yeah. So the average there is a bit more forgiving.
Yeah. About 1 minute and 35 seconds per question.
Mm-hmm.
So standard active testing time is approximately 2 hours and 14 minutes.
Yep.
That doesn't count the administrative setup before you start or the break. And just a quick note, students with approved accommodations might have different timing setups entirely.
Oh, absolutely. That's a good point to clarify.
But I want to talk about this module system because taking a digital test isn't just a continuous scroll down a single page. It's sort of like being in an escape room.
I like that analogy.
Yeah. You can move freely around the current module you're in. You can skip a tough question, flag it, change your answers, jump around.
Right.
But once that timer hits zero and the module ends, the door locks behind you. You absolutely cannot go back to that module.
That escape room analogy is really spot on. You are contained within that specific boundary until the time expires. And all of this happens within the College Board's dedicated digital testing application, which is called Blue Book.
Right, Blue Book.
Yeah, and the College Board designed Blue Book to include a very specific suite of built-in tools. For example, during the entire math section, you have access to a built-in Desmos graphing calculator directly on the screen.
Oh, that's huge.
It is, though you are still allowed to bring your own approved physical calculator if you prefer.
Good to know.
And in reading and writing, you have an annotation tool to highlight text. For all multiple choice questions, there is an option eliminator, which lets you visually cross out answers you know are dead ends.
That's so helpful for just clearing the visual clutter.
Exactly. You can also flag questions you want to return to before the module time runs out.
But here is where the digital format gets really fascinating.
Okay.
Blue Book isn't just a static PDF displaying on your screen. It actually reacts to your performance. The digital SAT uses a multi-stage adaptive engine. Can you walk us through how that routing actually works?
Yeah, absolutely. The underlying system is called multi-stage adaptive testing, or MST.
Okay.
Here is the mechanism in practice. We mentioned that each section, reading and writing and math, is divided into two modules.
Right.
The first module you encounter in a section is the routing module. It contains a broad mixed range of easy, medium, and hard questions.
So everyone gets that mix.
Exactly. The testing engine evaluates your performance on that first module in real time. Based on how you handle that broad mix, the engine then routes you to a second module.
Okay.
This second module will contain questions that are, on average, either generally more difficult or generally less difficult than the first module. It is simply trying to find the most precise measurement of your specific skills without forcing you to sit through hours of questions that are either way too easy or impossibly hard for you.
So it's just about efficiency.
It's entirely about measurement precision. The SAT is a predictable assessment. It is not an algorithm that you can game. And trying to guess which module you are in while you are taking the test is a massive waste of cognitive energy.
Yeah, don't do that.
The only viable strategy for the adaptive engine is simply to try your absolute best on every single question in front of you.
So ignore the man behind the curtain. Don't try to psychoanalyze the test while you're taking it.
Exactly.
If the engine is just looking for precision, what exactly is it measuring in the English section? We established it's not a basic grammar check. So how do they break down the skills?
The reading and writing section is categorized into four distinct domains.
Okay.
And it helps to think of them not as a list of topics, but as four different ways of thinking.
I like that.
First, you have information and ideas. This requires you to act like an investigator, you know, locating, interpreting, and evaluating information in text or informational graphics.
Okay.
Second is standard English conventions. This is the foundational architecture.
Yeah.
The core rules of sentence structure, usage, and punctuation.
Right.
Third is expression of ideas. This domain asks you to be an editor, revising texts to improve how effectively they achieve a specific rhetorical goal, like smoothly transitioning between two competing thoughts.
Mm.
And finally, you have craft and structure.
Now, based on our sources, craft and structure is a massive piece of the puzzle.
It really is.
It makes up about 28% of the questions, which is the heaviest weight of any domain in this section.
Yep.
It includes questions about vocabulary and context, understanding the structure and purpose of a text, and making connections between two related texts.
Yay.
Why is this specific domain so heavily weighted?
It's weighted heavily because it requires a high level of linguistic sophistication.
Ah.
According to the preparation methodology from Idiomist Watson Learning, it is also the domain where students make their most expensive errors.
Expensive how?
Well, in craft and structure, the SAT doesn't care if you have a dictionary definition memorized. It tests syntax and function.
Function meaning how the word works in the sentence.
Exactly. For example, in a text structure and purpose question, they aren't asking you to just summarize what the paragraph says. They're asking you what a specific phrase actually does within the mechanical structure of the paragraph.
Oh, I see.
Does that phrase introduce an objection to the main argument? Does it provide a concrete example of a previous claim?
And this leads to a huge insight about how wrong answers, the distractors, are actually built.
Yes.
Because if I'm reading a paragraph about climate science, a really common distractor trap is an answer choice that is a completely true statement based on the paragraph.
Right.
But it totally fails to answer the specific function the prompt asked for.
Exactly. It's a true sentence, but a false answer.
That is so tricky.
That is the trap. If the prompt asks for the main purpose of a sentence and your selected option just repeats a fact found in that sentence, you've likely fallen for a distractor.
Wow.
It tests whether you are reading for precision and function, or if you are just skimming to get the general vibe of the paragraph.
Which brings us back to that Bogota student from the intro. When we look at the words in context questions within this domain, so many students think the solution is just to memorize massive lists of obscure vocabulary words and translate them.
Yeah, they do.
But the effective strategy goes in a completely different direction.
Memorizing outdated vocabulary lists is an incredibly inefficient use of time.
I bet.
The words tested on the digital SAT are usually high-utility academic words you probably already recognize.
Right.
The real challenge is determining which word logically fits the highly specific syntax of the sentence provided. The recommended strategy for words in context is surprisingly physical.
Physical? How so?
When you see the question, literally cover the four answer choices with your hand or a piece of scratch paper.
All right.
Read the paragraph, look at the blank space, and formulate your own guess for what the word should be before you ever look at the options.
Because if you read the options first, the test makers have designed at least two of them to sound perfectly natural when you plug them in.
Exactly.
Do you end up choosing what sounds right to your ear rather than what is logically required by the sentence structure?
Precisely. And for an international student, what sounds right might be heavily influenced by the idioms or phrasing of their native language.
Oh, well, that makes so much sense.
If you determine the necessary meaning first, based strictly on the context clues in the text, you rely on your own logical deduction rather than being swayed by well-designed distractors.
That is such a powerful shift in perspective. But if we're talking about precision and function in language, how does that translate to the math section?
Well,
I mean, numbers are theoretically absolute. Is the math section just pure calculation, or are there function traps there too?
The logic absolutely carries over. Yeah. Having the built-in Desmos calculator is a fantastic tool for efficiency, but Desmos doesn't do the thinking for you. It only executes the commands you give it.
Right. It's just a tool.
The math section is also grouped by different styles of reasoning, broken into four domains.
Okay. What are they?
Algebra focuses on linear equations and inequalities. This is the foundational language of math.
Sure.
Advanced math moves into nonlinear equations, quadratics, and exponentials. This is about complex modeling.
Okay.
Problem solving and data analysis focuses on ratios, rates, and interpreting data from charts and graphs.
Got it.
And finally, geometry and trigonometry, which tests spatial reasoning with lines, angles, triangles, and circles.
Let's talk about problem solving and data analysis for a second. Looking at the sources, this almost feels like reading comprehension disguised as math.
It kind of is, yeah.
It's not just about crunching numbers, it's about translating real-world scenarios into mathematical equations. Can you give me an example of how a student might fall into a trap here?
A classic example involves answering the wrong prompt, very similar to what we discussed in the reading section. Let's say you have a complex algebra problem.
Okay.
You do a massive series of calculations, you isolate the variable, and you determine that x equals 5.
Right.
You look at the options, and option A is 5.
Boom, I'm clicking it.
The relief washes over you, you click option A, and you move on. But you missed that the actual question prompt asked for the value of 2x.
Oh, no.
The test makers know you will calculate 5, so they put it there as a distractor.
That's brutal.
You did all the math correctly, but you failed the decision-making part of the question.
It's a test of attention to detail under fatigue. And we also have to talk about the fact that you can't just guess your way through the whole math section.
Right.
About 75% of the questions are multiple choice. But what about the other 25%?
The remaining 25% are what the College Board calls student-produced response questions.
Okay, what does that mean?
There are no options to choose from. You calculate the answer and type it directly into the Blue Book interface.
Oh, wow. So no multiple choice at all.
Right. This completely removes the safety net of guessing or working backward from the answer choices. It requires a much higher level of confidence in your mathematical execution.
Okay, so a student navigates the reading traps, handles the math without falling for distractors, and finishes the test.
Yep.
Eventually, they get a score report. We all know the famous 400 to 1600 scale, which is just the sum of your two section scores. But when a student actually looks at that report, how should they interpret those numbers?
When you open the report, you'll see your total score and your two section scores, which each range from 200 to 800.
Oh.
But the raw number is just the beginning. The report provides percentiles, showing how you performed relative to a representative group of other students.
Right.
It also displays score ranges. This is the College Board acknowledging that a test score is just a snapshot. If you took the test multiple times, your score would naturally fluctuate within a student band.
That makes sense.
But perhaps the most functional way to interpret your score is by looking at college readiness benchmarks.
What are those?
The College Board sets these benchmarks to indicate whether a student has a high likelihood of success in entry-level, credit-bearing college coursework.
Okay.
Your target score should really be viewed in the context of those benchmarks, the specific requirements of the universities you are applying to, and your own personal academic growth over time.
So it's a snapshot of current readiness, not a permanent label.
Exactly.
So we've covered the structure, the adaptive engine, the domains, and the scoring. But for the student sitting at their desk in Columbia right now, all this theory is useless without a plan of attack.
Very true.
How do they actually begin?
The very first step is to recognize and avoid the most common preparation mistakes.
Like what?
The absolute biggest mistake is practicing without a strict timer.
As
we've discussed, the time pressure is practically half the difficulty of the SAT. Doing untimed modules gives you a false sense of security and provides a completely inaccurate diagnosis of your actual abilities.
Yeah, because anyone can get it right if they have an hour for one question.
Exactly. Another major mistake for international students is assuming that just studying general English grammar or continuing their standard high school English coursework will naturally raise their SAT score.
But they're different things.
They are. Once you have that solid B2 foundation, you have to transition to studying the specific formats, logical structures, and distractor patterns of the SAT itself.
So if untimed practice gives a false diagnosis, the absolute first step has to be a timed diagnostic test. You have to know where your baseline is.
Without a doubt.
Students can use the free, full-length practice tests right inside the Bluebeck app, or utilize the timed diagnostic modules provided by Idiomas Watson Learning. But once you have that baseline, what do you do with it?
Taking a practice test just measures your current state. The way you review that practice test is what actually improves you.
Right.
There is a highly specific three-step review method you should apply to every single mistake you make, and honestly, even to the questions you guessed correctly but weren't sure about.
Walk me through those three steps, because this feels like the core of the whole strategy.
Yeah.
Step one is finding the evidence, right? You can't just read the explanation, say, oh, that makes sense, and move on.
Correct. Step one, you must return to the text and find the exact line or the specific mathematical rule that proves the correct answer is correct. You have to anchor it in evidence.
Okay, anchor it.
Step two is where the real cognitive rewiring happens. You must state explicitly, ideally out loud, exactly why the distractor you chose was wrong. You have to name the trap.
Name the trap. Like, did it confuse a true statement with the main purpose?
Exactly.
Did it use a word that was too absolute? Like always or never? Did you solve for X instead of 2X?
Yes, all of those. Naming the specific trap trains your brain to recognize that exact pattern the next time it appears.
And step three is how you organize those mistakes. You group your errors by type, not just by test section. So if I missed 5 questions across a practice test and they all involved misunderstanding the function of punctuation, like, you know, misusing a semicolon, I don't have 5 separate random problems. I have 1 punctuation problem.
And that changes the entire psychology of studying. You go from feeling overwhelmed by a mountain of random errors to having a specific actionable target to fix.
That's huge.
Which brings us to how you structure your study timeline. The sources suggest a study plan that is actually counterintuitive.
How so?
You do not study the test in the order the questions appear.
Oh, wait. So I don't just start at question one and work my way through. What's the sequence?
You should study in reverse order of how difficult the underlying skills are to fix.
Okay.
You want to start your preparation with the standard English conventions domain.
Why that one first?
Because grammar and punctuation rules are closed systems. There is a finite set of rules for how to use a comma, a dash, or a colon.
Right.
You can learn those rules relatively quickly, and once you master them, your score in that domain improves rapidly and predictably.
You secure those quick, predictable wins first to build momentum. Then where do you go?
Next, you move to expression of ideas. These questions often involve choosing logical transitions between sentences or synthesizing bulleted notes into a single cohesive thought.
So it's still pretty structured.
Yeah, the logic here is straightforward once you understand what the prompt is prioritizing. After that, focus on information and ideas, which requires disciplined, careful evidence gathering.
But wait, that leaves craft and structure for last? The domain with the heaviest weight, the 28% we talked about earlier.
Right.
Why put the biggest challenge at the end?
Well, You don't leave it for the end of your timeline. You treat it as an ongoing long-term project from day one.
Oh, I see.
Craft and structure measures your sensitivity to linguistic nuance and textual architecture. You cannot cram for that in a weekend.
Yeah, that makes sense.
The best way to build that specific skill is to read high-quality, complex nonfiction in English every single day. Read science journalism, history articles, and analytical essays.
So you're just absorbing the structure over time.
Exactly. Pay close attention to how authors structure their arguments, the transitions they use, and the specific vocabulary they choose. It's a slow, cumulative build, but it's the most durable way to improve in the most heavily weighted domain.
Okay, let's bring this all together into some concrete next actions for our listener. If you are starting your SAT journey right now, here is your immediate to-do list.
Let's hear it.
Number one, download the Bluebake app to the exact device you plan to use on test day. Get deeply familiar with the interface, the Desmos calculator, and the annotation tools.
Essential.
Number two, set aside 2.5 hours, sit in a quiet room, and take an official, strictly timed diagnostic test. Do not pause the timer to get a snack. Respect the clock.
Shoot it like the real thing.
Number three, take those results and rigorously apply the three-step review method. Find the evidence, name out loud why your wrong answer was wrong, and group your errors by pattern. Finally, build your study plan, starting with the fastest fixes, like standard English conventions, while committing to reading daily nonfiction to build your craft and structure skills over the long haul.
It truly requires a comprehensive shift in how you view preparation.
Yeah, it really does.
The SAT isn't testing how many disconnected facts you have memorized in high school. It evaluates how you handle evidence, apply logic, and make decisions when the clock is ticking.
Right.
But if we connect this to the bigger picture, mastering these specific skills, reading for function, analyzing data carefully, avoiding cognitive traps under pressure, these aren't just tricks for a single Saturday morning.
What are they then?
These are the exact cognitive demands you will face during your first year of college. When you prepare for the SAT this way, you aren't just studying for an admissions test. You are actively training your brain for the reality of university-level academics.
Mm, that completely flips the script. You aren't just jumping through a hoop. You are building the exact mental muscles you'll need on day one of your freshman year. A predictable puzzle of logic that prepares you for what comes next.
Exactly.
That's all for this deep dive into the digital SAT. Download that app, take that timed diagnostic, start grouping those errors, and we'll see you next time.